John Quincy Adams might be an early victim of the American political disease, Potomac Fever. The sixth president of the United States served one term, returned to his home in Massachusetts, but then a few years later ran for Congress and served in the House of Representatives until his death in 1948. Over the past few days, a new class of freshly elected politicians arrived in Washington, and the odds are, even after they're defeated or retire, many will stay here, going through what's called the revolving door. That's when lawmakers or political appointees trade their relatively modest government salaries for lucrative lobbying gigs on K Street. Critics charge that this storied Washington practice gives lawmakers incentives to do favors for the industries they're supposed to watch over in office in expectation of rewards once they leave. That said, some politicians choose other doors, high-profile jobs at think tanks, the presidency of a university, a law practice back home. Almost all find themselves making a great deal more money than they did while in office in Washington. Later in the hour, a cantankerous battle over ethics in the House of Representatives and a change in parliamentary procedure. We'll also talk about problems posed by the proliferation of lasers. But first, second acts in American political life. If you or a family member have ever served in public office, what are you up to now? Do politicians make too much money in office or too little? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Steve Bartlett, a Republican congressman for Texas's 3rd District from 1983 to 1991. He went on to be elected mayor of Dallas for one term, and now he's back in Washington as president of the Financial Services Roundtable, a trade association. Steve Bartlett is with us by phone. Good to have you with us on Talk of the Nation.
Good to be with you, Kent.
And I don't know whether to call you congressman or mayor.
Well, a lot of people have that trouble. You can call me Steve. But when I'm in Washington, they usually call me congressman. When I'm in Dallas, they usually call me mayor, and sometimes I get it mixed up.
Well, you graced the halls of Congress for 8 years, which is a pretty good run. Did it seem like forever?
I enjoyed it. I loved every minute of it. It didn't seem like forever. It actually almost went past in the blink of an eye. I was one of those that never did want to stay forever. I never did want to make a career out of it, but I was pretty good at it, and so I just kept getting reelected. So 8 years is a long time. It seemed to me that was about the right length of time.
What was it like to pack your bags after 4 terms?
Well, I was on a mission to do something else, and so I didn't really think of it as looking back on any kind of nostalgia, because I was on a mission to make some fairly major changes to the city of Dallas as mayor. So I spent most of my time thinking about that. After that happened, frankly, I went back to the real world for about 3 years and enjoyed it, but got to missing politics.
Missing politics? What about this wonderful profession did you miss?
Most people who are in fact, by definition, people are in Congress or mayor or governor or high level. In order to get there, you have to go through so much in terms of the campaign and the competitive nature of it and understand politics that, by definition, everybody who does it is a policy wonk, to use a term. Mm-hmm. Somebody, they're driven by the passion of their views on public policy, and so it's the policy that drives people who are in this business. And whether you're involved in the policy wonk business in Congress or at a trade association or as mayor or at the head of the CIA, where Portagos is now, that's what drives people who are in this business, and that's actually quite a good thing.
Yeah, Portagos, of course, a long-term congressman from the state of Florida. You mentioned time in the real world. You were involved in plastics manufacturing?
Yes. I had owned a business when I came to Congress in 1974 in the small manufacturing company. Kept it all the years I was in Congress and as mayor. My business partner ran it. And then when I left mayor, I'd been in public life in terms of elected or major appointed office for some 20 years. I decided I would give a go of just business and only do business, and I was pretty good at it. And at the end of 3 years, my wife pointed out to me that I was pretty good at it, but I was really great at politics, and maybe I ought to get back into something where I could combine the two.
So, which is how you get back to Washington, D.C.
So I sold my business and came back, and I now have the best of both worlds. I'm in the for-profit world and the business world, which is a passion of mine also, but I get to come at it from the perspective of public policy, of how do you create a mortgage market system, for example, that the 70% of the American homeowners can own a home, or or be able to obtain the consumer credit at a moment's notice, or all those things that are set by politics.
And scratch that political itch. At the same time, I suspect you make more money than members of Congress.
Well, I do. Probably if you average it out over the last 30 years, it'll be about average. But today I'm on the high end of the average, yes.
And that's
the way it should be, by the way. That is, public service, when you're elected office, you know, we need to pay our elected officials enough that they can be comfortable and can live, but we don't want to pay them a salary that where they're paid more than they can make somewhere else. I think you want to keep that note of public service to it.
Now that you're back inside the Beltway, do you ever revisit your old haunts on Capitol Hill?
Well, sure. I see my friends and colleagues, and of course, part of my business at a trade association is to develop public policy and to advocate that public policy. So, some part of my life is devoted to that, and I see my friends and colleagues, make new friends. So, Washington is they do call it inside the Beltway for a reason. It is somewhat of a bubble, and I think the congressmen that are good at it, they can work inside the bubble, but they also keep their feet on the ground in terms of understanding what's happening in the real world. And it's a blend. It's a blend. You have to do both.
Why do you think so many politicians and political appointees stick around Washington after they retire or leave public office?
Well, I come at two ways on that. First of all, I think a lot fewer than you think. I think the conventional wisdom is, as you stated it, that the conventional wisdom, everybody assumes that everybody who is in Congress, they stick around and they lobby for a living afterwards. And I think most don't, actually, if you just look at the numbers. What happens is the people that you read about are the ones that stuck around because they stick around, and that makes for an interesting news story. But by and large, if you look at most retired members of Congress, they mostly go off and do something else. The reason, though, what brings them back to Washington, and there's always a sort of a club there, is the passion for public policy. If you run for Congress, you have a passion for the private enterprise system, or for the labor union system, or for social welfare, or for education, or for strong national defense. And you didn't get that passion just with the day you got sworn in, and you don't lose it the day you leave. So what brings you back is that passion.
Steve Bartlett, we'll call you Congressman since you're in mayor. Thanks very much in Washington. We appreciate your time today. Steve Bartlett, currently the president of the Financial Services Roundtable, a trade association here in D.C., a former congressman from Texas and former mayor of Dallas. And he joined us by phone from his office here in town, Washington, D.C. To get a better sense of how common Mr. Bartlett's story is, we turn to Larry Noble, executive director of the nonpartisan organization, the Center for Responsive Politics. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Steve Bartlett, is that an unusual path?
Not at all. It is common to see now a member of Congress go out. Some of them do run for office in the states, and some of them go out and get jobs at trade associations, become lobbyists, go to law firms. Some of them do go back home and never have anything to do with Washington again. But his path is not all that uncommon.
And what options are out there? I mean, there's a lot of different things people can do, but a lot of these people are professional politicians.
That's right. And a lot of them really come to Washington, stay here for quite a while in Congress, and what the experience they've gathered, their real expertise is in dealing with the government and is dealing with legislation. And those are the ones who often go out. They can head up a trade association, become a lobbyist, go to a law firm, and what they're selling back to clients is their expertise, is what they've now learned how to do. They've learned how to get legislation through. They've learned how to come up with a strategy. Also, what many of them have, great friends on the Hill. They have great friends in the federal agencies, and these are the type of people they can call on. So it's a good business for many of them.
And a former congressman has access to the floor of the House of Representatives.
That's right. A former congressman can go to the floor of the House of Representatives. Now, the rules in the House say that they're not supposed to lobby when they do that. And that's a lifetime prohibition of lobbying when you're on the floor. But the reality is you're there meeting your friends, making dates for drinks afterwards, and it's a very, very fine line that they've developed there.
Or the congressional gym. I guess there's right. No strictures there.
Right, correct. There's no strictures there. And there are dinner parties, there are outings, there are all sorts of ways to really get close to your former colleagues.
If you'd like to join our conversation, by the way, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, totn@npr.org. Griffin is calling from Austin, Texas.
Hello, how are you?
Very well.
I talked to my representative about raising the salaries of public officials. That was my approach. So they don't have to go somewhere else for money, and they don't have to pad out their expense accounts just to make living expenses while they're in office. And I think this was fairly successful. In fact, Clinton arranged to raise the president's salary, the president to be elected after him. I think George Bush actually thanked Clinton for raising his salary. I think maybe this is a good idea.
Should congressional salaries be higher, do you think, Larry Noble?
You know, that is a very difficult question. Right now, the congressional salary is about $160,000 a year, and that's far more than most Americans make. And I think most Americans hear that figure and they say, I could definitely live on $160,000 a year. On the other hand, most members of Congress will tell you they have to have two homes, one here, one back in their district. Also, on one hand, you can compare it to what people make in everyday life, but a lot of them are comparing it to what heads of trade associations make, $1 million a year, $2 million a year. Congressman Towson, former Congressman Towson, just went to work for Pharma, and the estimate I've heard is around $2 million a year he's going to make. So their argument is, yes, we're making $160,000. We could be making 10 times as much of that as that. And others will say, but $160,000 is a lot of money. I have no problem with paying them enough to make the job worthwhile, but it is public service, and public service is never going to pay what the private sector pays.
Still, some critics say that you find people coming to Washington who see making a government salary for a few years as an investment, which they then cash in after they leave office.
Absolutely. And I think, and it's been said before, that there are three types of people that go into government service. There are those that go in the beginning of their careers, and they look at it as, in a sense, postgraduate experience. And what they'll do is they'll get the experience, they'll make the contacts, and then they can go out and sell that somewhere else. There are those who come in after a long career in the private sector, and they want to do some public service. They've made their money, and they're not that concerned about the money issue. And then they're then what I would call the public servants, the ones who are in it for a long career. They know they're not going to make a lot of money. They want to make a decent living. And many of those go in with the idea of staying for a long time, but the financial realities hit them eventually, and the job offers hit them eventually, and they decide to leave.
Griffin, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. We're talking about second acts in political life, where lawmakers go after they leave office and what they do when they get there. If you were ever an elected official, if you ever served in Congress, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan, back after a short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about life after public service. Some go through the revolving door. Others head to academe or go home. Our guest is Larry Noble, Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Of course, you're invited to join us. 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Politicians are hot property these days. Leonard Pfeiffer is a Washington headhunter who helps companies find top executives, many of whom come from the federal government. He's also with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Happy to be here.
We were talking earlier about former Senator Breaux. He's being pursued by some, and Representative Towson, who went to work for Pharma, an industry group that represents the drug manufacturers around the country. These are plum jobs.
No question about that, but there's a lot of other jobs out there as well for chiefs of staff, et cetera, people off the Hill, people with the administration, not just the congressmen and senators. Mm-hmm.
What makes all those people so attractive?
I think part of what Steve Bartlett touched on before and what Larry touched on, they're individuals that know their way around the system. They understand how to get things done here. A perfect example is that a year or so ago, we were retained by a healthcare organization to help them find somebody who knew international trade. We brought on board a woman from the Commerce Department who really had a strong knowledge base of trade between the U.S. and Asia. I believe, and I don't know the exact figure, but that because of her insight as to moving back and forth between those countries, she was able to save what the industry regarded as tens of millions of dollars in trade taxes, trade revenues, whatever it is, that they wouldn't have to pay to Japan, to Malaysia, to wherever it is, by just understanding the system and understanding who to get to say what to where.
So this is worth a lot of money to
them. A lot of money.
And obviously the salary that Representative Towson, former Representative Towson, reportedly has of $2 million, unusual, but nevertheless, you're never going to make up that gap between what they're paid in office and what they could make in private sector.
No, but I think I need to step in there and say there are about 5,000 of these trade associations and professional societies in the country. And by professional societies, a perfect example is the National Association of Realtors and the American Institute of CPAs. of those 5,000 CEOs, maybe 20, maybe as many as 50 of them earn those $750 million packages. A lot of those other people earn a lot less than that.
Mm-hmm. You've worked with some big names in government. For example, you recruited Andy Card, a former Secretary of Transportation, for a job at the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. How does this process work? Did the automobile manufacturers approach you?
In that particular case, they actually did. They said, we're looking for a new president, and can you help us? In many cases, and again, citing back to that international trade one, someone will hear about the work we're doing and will call us up and say, hey, I like what you did for XYZ. Mm-hmm. Can you come meet with our board of directors? Because we will need a new CEO, or we'll need a new executive vice president of international, or whatever it is. And then from there, we sit down with that board and help them define what they're looking for. And then we go out and we headhunt. We go and look for that person.
Okay, let's get another listener involved in the conversation. Jeff is with us from Charlottesville, Virginia.
Hi. I would like to ask you guys if you think that this back and forth between government and industry would end up in decisions of the government being made like they were business decisions. And I wonder if that is the right way to run a government. You know, we hear a lot about government of, by, and for corporations. And I wonder if you could speak to that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Larry Noble?
Well, I think there are really two ways of looking at that question. One, if you're asking whether or not it leads to people who've come up through the private sector treating the government like the private sector. I think there are cases like that, where you've been in the private sector for a long time, been in a business, and you come into the government, and the government is different. It is different. We often talk about the need to make the government act more like the private sector, but the reality is the interests are different, the economics are different, so you do sometimes see problems like that with people coming in. The other issue is the policy issue of whether these people bring with them the policy perspective of the industries, and yes, they do. In many cases, they very much do bring with them the industry's policy perspective. Some people argue that's not bad. Sometimes an administration will say, we want to get people in from the industry who understand how the industry works. Other people think that what happens is you get a captive agency. You get an agency that only responds to the industry, and where you have an agency that's supposed to be a watchdog, an oversight agency, that can be a problem if there's a real feeling there that what it's doing is responding to what the industry wants, not necessarily what the public needs.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk, obviously, there are ethical questions that arise after people leave office and then return, sometimes working for the same industries that they used to be the watchdogs of. There are obviously rules, but nevertheless, there is a whiff of corruption about this.
Well, there is what many people call an appearance of corruption. And I think you have to be careful with it, because in many instances, when somebody gets experience with the government and goes out and uses that experience and comes back, people accept that, and it's seen as one of the things people do. Where the real problem comes in, I think, is where people are suspected of having negotiated while they're with the government for a new job, or getting a new job because of what they did for a company or industry when they were in the government. And also the problem is when they go out, when they come back in using that special expertise to try to get special benefits for an industry or a company that otherwise would not get them. And so there's a feeling out there, if you're up against one of these people, that you can't, it's not a level playing field, mm-hmm. That they have an inside track that you don't have, either if you're another company or if you're in the a private citizen, and you feel like there's no way I can deal with the pharma, with fight against pharma, because pharma has Tausen there, and how can I possibly deal with that?
Yeah. Let me bring that up with you, Leonard Pfeiffer. Is this issue of ethics, conflict of interest, or potential conflict of interest, does that come up in these negotiations?
I think it does, and it's particularly with the sensitivity that Larry just brought up with some of the Pentagon contracts, etc. But having said that, in the recruiting we do, we're highly, highly sensitive to that and look to make sure that anybody we're recruiting for our client hasn't come anywhere near touching on one of those lines. The line being quite simply, we're not going to recruit somebody purposefully out of a government organization who has been the watchdog over a particular industry without very carefully checking with our client organization and with the individual himself or herself, mm-hmm. to see if there's any ethical question here. Industry right now can't risk that and won't risk that. And when I'm saying industry, I mean the trade associations and the corporations. They just won't risk that.
And obviously, they're hiring these people for access for their information they have. The last thing they want is bad publicity.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the access can be wonderful, but, you know, one, you know, headline in the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and the New York Times can do millions of dollars in damage, as you can imagine.
Okay. I wanted to thank Larry Noble for being with us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Larry Noble joined us here in Studio 3A. He's Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics. Members of Congress, of course, are not the only ones who have to face tough questions of what's next after public service. Administration officials have to plot out their futures, whether they resign or whether their boss is voted out. Joining us now is Tom Scully, former head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for President Bush. He's now a lawyer with the firm Alston & Byrd and has joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Sure.
Now, you present an interesting case. You resigned early to take a job in the private sector. How come?
I said pretty clearly when I went in the beginning of the Bush administration. I'd been in the government for 12 years before. I was planning to stay for 2 or 3 years, and I told Secretary Thompson and others that as soon as the Medicare bill was done, I was probably going to leave. So I left roughly January 1st last year, right after the Medicare bill was passed, which I've been pretty clear about saying I was going to do all along. Mm-hmm.
And when you announced your decision to leave and when you left, did people like Mr. Pfeiffer call your phone?
It's a long story. I'd been a lawyer for many years. In fact, I've been in the government for 13, 14 years. I believe it or not, I started out with Larry Noble in 1979 at the Federal Election Commission. And I worked in the Senate for years, and I was in the White House and OMB at the first Bush administration. So part of this thing about the revolving door is frustrating to me. I've been in the government for 14 years. This is the first time I ever left voluntarily. Usually in the past, my bosses had lost, which doesn't give you a lot of options.
No.
So people complain about the revolving door. Believe me, I was involuntarily revolved a number of times. So in this case, what had happened, to be honest, is I gotten a call from a law firm, the law firm I'm with, which did not have a health care practice, had no health care clients. The partner who ran it was a friend of mine, Senator Dole, who was there. Mm-hmm. I had helped recruit for this friend of mine the year before. And when they called me, I went to the general counsel of HHS and Secretary Thompson and said, what's the appropriate thing to do? And they said, the appropriate thing to do is file a waiver, which I did. And I really didn't talk to him again for months and months and months. Later on when I left, unfortunately, I ended up ruining the waiver process for other government employees forever, which is very frustrating. But there was this perception that since I'd filed a waiver, which was exactly the correct way to do by the book in May of 2003, and then subsequently went on to work on the Medicare bill, that somehow I was working with this law firm all the time. The law firm had no health care practice, had no health care clients. Yet when I left, and I ended up talking to a number of law firms as I left in December of 2003, ended up going to this one because I had some friends there. It's very frustrating as a person who likes government, likes public service, thought I was trying to do the right thing. And when you leave, you get this perception that somehow you were negotiating the Medicare bill and handing out favors to friends, which in my opinion is ludicrous. There's zero evidence of that. The fact that it didn't happen, and I'm very proud of the bill, very proud of my work, but it's frustrating to have yourself strung out over the front of the New York Times when that kind of thing happens. And whether you're a Democrat or Republican, if you like public service, going through that is not fun.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, Leonard Pfeiffer, when officials get revolved, as Tom Scully just put it, is it relatively easy to land on your feet?
I think so, but it depends on what's hot at the time and where they've been. For example, international trade is hot now. Healthcare is hot now. Tax issues are hot now. So if somebody's been working with those, whether they're Democrat or Republican, I think they're going to have a much easier time of finding a new position outside of the government than in some other area that may not be hot.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. And John is calling from Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Yes, I was interested in the comment made about the salary of the government official and the fact that that does not include the lifelong medical benefits and the compensation on retirement, even if they only serve one term in office. Is that correct?
Is that right, Leonard Pfeiffer? I believe it is.
As far as I know, it is, yes.
Yeah.
So they do get lifelong medical benefits?
No,
and they
not federal employees. You mean congressmen and senators?
You're talking about congressmen and senators, yes.
They get a very prorated one. If you're a congressman for 2 years, you get a very limited benefit, or a senator for 6 years. You have to be in a fairly long time to get lifelong benefits at any significant level.
Well, senators are restricted in terms, so it doesn't take them very long to have lifelong benefits and also have a substantial retirement, I believe, isn't it?
I believe it is, John, yes. And the point is?
Yes.
And your point is?
That the salary may seem low for Washington, D.C., but if I could go take a job like that for 8 years and walk away with lifelong benefits, that would be a heck of a deal, I thought.
Well, let me just point. I worked for
Tom Scully.
I worked for Senator Gorton from Washington State from 1980 to 85. And what people forget is he lived in Seattle, had a house in Washington, D.C., had a house in Seattle. His family's travel back and forth wasn't paid for. I think the salary at the time was about $75,000, $80,000 a year. And I did his taxes. I can tell you certainly it's more than the average American makes, and I don't think people should feel sorry for politicians. But the fact is he could have done many, many other things that were much more lucrative, and it was definitely not a plush existence. I mean, people forget that if you're from California or Washington State or Oregon, not only do you have to have two homes, but your family, the government doesn't pay for any of their travel or any of the second home.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call, John. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're talking about second acts in American political life. What do politicians and officials do once they leave office? You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Tom Scully, let me just follow up on that last point. I think when Tom Ridge announced that he was leaving as the head of Homeland Security and was talking about, one of the things, he had two kids in college and how difficult it was on his salary to do that. There was an editorial, I think, in the York, Pennsylvania newspaper after this saying, they had no tears for the former governor of their state. And if he's having difficulty on the government salary, imagine how difficult it is for a normal American to put two kids through college, and that he and others like him are completely out of touch.
Well, I can certainly see that, because the average cabinet secretary or agency head like me makes significantly more in the government than the average person in America. And certainly you need to be sensitive to that. On the other hand, I have three daughters I'm trying to put through school, and my wife, who doesn't like politics, can't stand it, and would prefer that I never went into it. And I made, the year I ran a large trade association before I went back in the government, having been out for 8 years, and the year before I went in, I made many times, roughly 10 times what I made the year I went in the government. So from the point of a Tom Ridge or a point of my wife, I went back in because that was fun and I enjoyed it. From the point of my wife and kids, who'd rather have me practice law or do something else, on a relative basis, it's hard to complain. I tried not to complain around my employees. With 5,000 employees, I was obviously one of the higher paid people in the agency. So it's hard to complain when you're making, I think I made $130,000 a year, which is a very healthy income. On the other hand, many of these people, like Tom Ridge, like myself, could go out, practice law, have done other things, and make quite a bit more. I happen to like public service. I've done it for 14 years off and on. I think it's an honorable, great thing to do. But, you know, for your wife and kids' point of view, there are a lot of things that would be a lot more fun for them. So,
go ahead, Lenny.
I'd have to agree with that, because we have to compare apples to apples here. We're talking about leaders, senior executives, frankly, congressmen, senators, assistant secretaries, secretaries, and we have to compare them to leaders in the American corporate world. No, the man working in a factory in Indiana probably doesn't earn $130,000 a year, but there's hundreds of thousands of U.S. corporations that pay their people well in excess of that, and so we need to compare what these congressmen, senators, people like Tom Scully had done and what they could do in corporate America.
Well, Mark McClellan, who took my place, is a terrific guy. I believe has a PhD in economics, has a law degree and a medical degree from Harvard and Stanford, has an unbelievable academic background. I think he loves what he's doing, but he could probably go run any medical center in the country. And if he was running Stanford or Harvard Medical Center just as a nonprofit hospital, he'd be making 6, 7, 8 times as much.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Tina from San Francisco.
Yes, hi. Well, my comment deals with the fact that if you are in the private sector and you are in a responsible position that would be comparable, generally you have to sign a non-compete clause for X number of years if you leave. And why is that not appropriate if you decide to go into government service, which is an admirable thing to do? It is less pay, but you still have an advantage coming out of those who haven't been in government service and dealing with, as say, a lobbyist or whatever. Why is that not a feasible possibility, that there is in essence a non-compete period?
Mm-hmm. Leonard?
Well, if I understand the question correctly, there basically is, and Tom, you can jump in here, but when someone leaves government service, I believe that they cannot call on, let's say that someone leaves the government service and joins a trade association, they cannot then go back and lobby the specific department in the government, the specific agency or whatever it is, for a number of years. To use your phrase, Tina, a non-compete clause for a year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever it is. I'm not sure the exact detail there, but I know there definitely
is
something.
It's 1 year for my agency. It's, if you go back and talk to the my agency about any generic issue in healthcare to 1 year, but it's a lifetime ban. If I worked on a specific issue for a hospital or for a doctor or for some very specific issue as a regulator, it's a lifetime ban never dealing with those issues again.
Tom Scott, we just have a few seconds left, but would you go back into public service?
Maybe. No, I've enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. I had a great time at CMS. I had 3 great years. I think we passed a terrific Medicare bill that as the substance starts to come out in the politics phase will turn out to be tremendous, especially for poor seniors. And I love doing that. But I think, some of the flack I got coming out, one of my frustrations, the reason I'm here, is I think for future people, Democrats, Republicans, going into the government, seeing what I've gone through and other people has not exactly enticed them to go into government service. It's very frustrating.
Tom Scully, now a lawyer with the firm Alston & Byrd, former head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. We are also speaking with Leonard Pfeiffer, a Washington headhunter who finds companies fine senior executives. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.